Hello? I see by the old clock on the wall that it's about 5 o'clock. I was riding on an airplane next to a businessman. And he said, what do you do? And I said, I design websites. And he said, wow. I loved 1998. And that same thing happened a few years later. I was introduced to someone, a really impressive entrepreneur, and he was really excited about the web and all kinds of things about the web, and he asked what I do, and I said, I design websites, and he said, oh. And he looked kind of sorry for me, like I'd learned, you know, like I churned butter, or I had some other skill that wasn't really going to make it in the next, you know, past the next few months. So I don't know. How many people in this room create web content one way or another? How many people in this room don't create web content one way or another? Okay. How many of you feel that other people, besides people that are here and people you work with, how many of you feel that everyone that you know understands what you do and values what you do? Okay, so that's what our panel's about. We're in these tight little communities, like this one, not little, but we're in these tight little communities where we speak this common language that no one else speaks, and we read these websites that no one else reads, and we argue passionately about things no one else understands. And even within, I mean, there's like the micro formats community, and right, there's all these different communities, the, you know, design community, all these communities that don't really communicate that well with each other. So what we want to do in this panel is talk a little bit about that, strategize ways to communicate better with each other and perhaps with clients and perhaps even with the wider public, you know, and the press. So that's what we're going to do in this talk. And then on a macro level, what we want to do is just try to figure out what it is that we do and what's the value of what we do, so we could summarize it. Someone asked me right before, a friend asked me right before this panel, what's this panel about? And I couldn't really answer that. So that's either a really bad sign or a really good sign. I'm not sure. But I think we're going to, hopefully we leave with a couple of questions and maybe a couple of answers. And on that, here's the orange slide that says, who are you? And I'm going to turn to the very talented people sitting beside me. I guess start at that end and work back this way. Who are you? What do you do? And what communities do you associate with or think of yourself as part of?
I'm Liz Danzico. I'm an information architect. First and foremost, I do a lot of information architecture work with HappyCog, which Jeffrey is the founder of. And I also am a user researcher. I do have an independent consulting business as doing usability stuff. I am an editor with a book company called Rosenfeld Media, where I help publish user experience books. I also publish a website called A Brief Message, which is an op-ed page for design, and am the former editor of Boxes and Arrows, which is an information architecture website. In terms of the communities I most associate myself with here, what I like, I don't know, it's hard to answer. Like what I like about South by Southwest is that you don't really have to associate yourself with a community. I guess if I had to choose a group and only talk to those people, it'd be the user experience group. But otherwise, I think I like this conference because I feel like I can associate with everyone here.
I'm Erin Kissain, and I'm a writer and an editor. I'm the editorial director at HappyCog with Liz and Jason and Jeffrey. And I also edit A List Apart magazine. And that is such a funny question, actually, about which community, because although most of my work with HappyCog and for our clients is editorial, because of my work at A List Apart, I really feel like even though I'm not doing design or doing front-end development, I am affiliated with all of the communities that go into making websites. So sort of somewhere in the middle.
My name is Jason Santa Maria. I'm the creative director at HappyCog Studios. Thank you. and I'm also the art director on A List Apart. I have a website, jasonsamaria.com. I guess the groups that I most identify with are probably more in the design discipline, whether it be graphic design or web design, type nerds, movie buffs, video gamers, foil fencers, jugglers, carnival folk. Is there anyone here at South by Southwest? This is Doug Bowman.
What else would you like to say about me?
My name's Doug Bowman, and I am an ex-blogger. It's an inside joke for anyone that hasn't read anything I've written for a while. I am a designer, although Google pegs me as a visual designer. It's the first time I've ever been called that, and that's fine. And I've been there for a couple of years now, and used to previously write at stopdesign.com. I still have that, just haven't touched it for a while. I've been way too busy. And let's see, what else? I think I'm obviously most aligning myself with designers, but I used to align myself with developers as well. I haven't written much code since I got to Google. There's lots of engineers that do that for me, which is a good thing because I didn't want to just be known as the CSS guy. So, what else? That's I think designers, developers, standardistas, although that's kind of a fading term, especially at Google, where they'll take out all their quotes and make their pages invalid for a reason. So,
what's the reason?
Speed.
Okay.
That's the only reason.
Okay. Cool. Okay. One more thing. One more who question before we really get into it. One thing I'm hoping we'll talk about in the next few minutes is. Who is in charge? Who runs the web experience for your company, your organization? How many people here work at an agency, right, or freelance? Okay, a lot of people. And how many people work in-house at some kind of like the web division of a company or work on the website of a company, university, something like that? Okay, a lot of people. Of the people who work in-house, how many of you are under the category of IT? Right. How many of you, so the IT department's in charge of your website. How many people, the marketing department's in charge of the website? Okay. Design department's in charge of the website. Communication department's in charge of the website. Okay. What am I forgetting? What else?
Distribution.
Distribution department? The distribution department's in charge of the website? Transportation?
Okay. Sanitation.
That's unusual. Okay. Okay. How many people work for the web division? Excellent. What's your secret? Small company? Anybody else? You are the department. Okay.
The entire division?
So there's a web division, but it's you. Okay, cool. I think we're going to come back to this, too, in terms of explaining the value of web work and explaining to journalists. One of the things that we did a while ago, we did a web design survey. Did anyone here take it, the web design survey? Okay, and some people were upset with us because we didn't ask things like, do you always use quotes in your hrefs, or... would you find yourself as a standardista, a hardcore standardista, or don't know what the question means? Like, but we just asked about salaries, and the reason we asked about salaries was that no one had ever done that before. There was no information on web design, so this is another thing that sort of got us thinking about what a strange profession we have that no one talks about it, no one knows what it is. There are very few web divisions at all these major companies, even though. Maybe the web division, the website is responsible for billions of dollars of income, you know, if it's Amazon or Google, right? I want to come back to that later, who's in charge and why. Another thing I think that we should talk about today is peering over the cubicle, right? So I guess the first thing to talk about is in the role that you have on the website or on web content, How do you talk to others in the company who have different jobs, and what processes are in place to allow you to communicate freely, respect each other, learn from each other, all that stuff, or what processes are in place that make you hate and fear each other? And I'll start with you, if I can, Doug, because you work at a company where, you know, the engineers are in charge. So how does that work?
Well, it's even further subdivided within even user experience, because user experience is as a whole department with, I can't be specific, but well over 100 people by now. And visual design is just one tiny small group within that user experience group. So not only are we communicating with engineers, but we're communicating within our own user experience group, because we're constantly working with designers that are already working on certain products. And our group by nature is so small right now that we have to kind of be a central group that kind of very selectively doles out resources and is very careful kind of who we can work with, because we just don't have that many visual designers at the company, at least designers that have specifically given the task of visual design. But talking with engineers, it's peering over the cubicle is kind of an apt description sometimes, because we tend to walk toward meetings and we're always walking by cubicles with these engineers in them, and they've got like, you know, four like big huge 24-inch screen monitors in front of them with all this code flying by, and it's like this foreign world that we're not quite used to. But in meetings, it's often just comes down to talking about the very practical nature of what we're doing, that how fast is this going to be? Is this going to improve what we're doing? Is this appropriate for Google's audience? Is this appropriate for the brand? And it often comes down to discussion of is this still going to be fast? Because speed trumps a lot there.
Who initiates projects and these conversations? Do they come from design?
They can come from everywhere within the company. Oftentimes they're engineering projects, but design, the user experience group has also started several projects within the company. PMs also will initiate the cross kind of division contact and pull the appropriate people into the room when it's necessary, although we constantly are kind of always fighting for a seat at the table. And I think that's always kind of been a battle among designers, is that especially engineers will tend to relegate us to, especially visual designers, like the people that just come in and kind of fill in the color at the end. And it's difficult to get a seat at the table kind of early on when they're just starting the product discussions or a new project discussion.
What have you done yourself? I imagine you do this all the time, but what do you do to make sure that you get a seat at the table? How do you just kind of gently keep being in people's faces to make sure that design is represented?
It's a lot of politics and relationship forming, really, I think. Constantly talking to people, constantly making sure that they're aware of what your services are and what you can do. Within just the user experience group itself, we have things like office hours where we make ourselves available to other people within the company on a kind of a regular basis, where even if we're not directly working with a project team, those teams can come to us and seek out our advice or our help, or at least figure out who they should be going and talking to.
Who wants it? Do you want to take it for Happy Con?
Could I refer to a past experience?
Past experience.
Some of the things that Doug was talking about remind me of when I was working in-house for the second largest distributor of books online. I was, you know, managing the information architecture group there. And our clients were internal, right? Our clients were the business units within this organization. And oftentimes, you know, we would present our information architecture, our design work to the client, and they would sort of like nod uncomfortably, like, yeah, it looks good, but like never sort of like feel like we didn't feel like we were connecting with them at all. And what would often happen during this time before we could communicate well is these clients would go home over the weekend, they would bring up Photoshop and create like the design that they wanted to see themselves and bring it back to us on Monday. Like, here, this is exactly what we need to see. And we realized that there was like a true lack of, I mean, clearly a lack of communication there. There's no vocabulary to talk about this. They didn't know how to use Photoshop very well at all. And so what we started doing was opening up that, like, sort of like embracing that and helping them draw out what they wanted. So instead of presenting them designs, we would actually give them blank sheets of paper. We do brainstorming sessions and let them draw exactly what they needed way before we started the design process. And that helped, like, open up those lines of communication.
You didn't then produce what they designed. You just allowed that to be a way of articulating, like visually articulating.
Yeah, that wouldn't have been a good idea. But yeah, we did. We used that just to inform. It was almost like a kind of visual requirements gathering. And then we used that to create our own wireframes, our own designs later on. And they felt like they were a part of the process, and they were. Although, you know, a lot of what they had drawn kind of got put under the table a little bit.
Anyone else? Has anyone worked at a place where there was bad communication and you were just really, you know, kind of put in a little box?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've worked at agencies before where the design portion of a project was pretty much like a day before it was supposed to launch, where, you know, all the development happens, the information architecture, all that gets figured out, and it's a working prototype. And then it's like, hey, put some color on this, maybe, and put the logo up there. Yeah, that has to be in there, too.
And make it bigger.
Yeah, and, of course. And then it was just like launching. So it was just, you were decorating stuff. You weren't really considered part of the process.
Were you able to do anything to change it, or did you just leave?
I would ignore people and just be generally mean during meetings and sort of, you know, quiet tactics like that.
But designers have their
bring
reputation.
Bring it down from the inside.
See, but designers have their reputation, too, and that works both ways. Who's worked with designers and found them very frustrating because they seem sort of elitist and like, I mean, you know, the designer's answer, yeah, okay, and the designer's answer is like, where did you go to art school? Right, when you present an idea to a designer, they're like, oh, that's interesting. So it's tough because that's, again, we're talking about like sort of peering at each other over the cubicle, but not communicating over the cubicle, mm-hmm. more like hating each other over the cubicle, right? Like, I just did an interview with a Dutch academic, and all he wanted to talk about was, why do developers and designers hate each other? And what can we do about that? He just kept asking that question over and over again in different ways. Not in different languages, but just the same question presented different ways. Who has that experience of antagonism at their job between people that you work with just not getting each other and... No? Everybody's cool? No, everybody... Okay, so... Okay, that was so unclear, Jeffrey. Okay, who has a problem communicating with other people on their web team and a lot of hostility involved? Hands up. Okay. Okay. And has anyone found a way of a satisfactory way of negotiating that and wants to run up to the mic and tell us what it was? Anybody broken through that?
Well, one of the key things from a political point of view that I think Liz kind of hinted at was making everyone else feel part of the process. Not only does that expose them to our design process, but that exposes us to what their thinking is, why they're thinking it either can or can't be like this. And in general, just opens up the communication a lot more, even if we can just give them a hint that they think that it was their idea. So that means not presenting the whole picture right away. That means kind of presenting kind of pieces of the picture and kind of guiding them along the way to say, like, this might be an appropriate solution, and kind of letting them fill in some of those pieces. And that gives them more ownership. And also makes the design process not this, like, nebulous cloud. Like, they don't know what happens when we go back to our computers and open up Photoshop or whatever we're doing.
Yeah. Plus, I learned something long ago that it's very difficult for me to respect something that I don't understand. If I was working with some sort of developer and they built this, you know, amazing back-end system and I didn't really understand how it happened, it's really difficult for me to respect that. Not because it isn't amazing, but because I don't really get what went into it. I don't understand the process. So I think that, sort of to Doug's point, information on both sides of that cubicle wall is really important. I need to understand what the developer's doing, what the coders are doing, and they need to understand what I'm doing in order to respect that.
And we use Basecamp. I would just like to say, we use Basecamp. And here's what I mean. Like the other day, Jason complained. We worked together, and Jason complained about something. He said, too many threads. And he was right. But the reason we do that is everybody involved has to know what's going on. Even if it's not, even if someone's building a back-end system, and we're doing usability analysis or figuring out what questions to ask, which user should we talk to and which questions should we ask. And in theory, the person who's doing the back end couldn't care less, doesn't need to know about that. All they really need to do is, when is the templates approved? Then I'll come in and do something. But we feel that it doesn't work well that way if everybody's, you know, everyone has certain skills that are, you know, that they're things they're better at, and we value that. But everyone needs to understand what everyone else is contributing to it in order, we do things like with content, where we bring content in real early, and IA informs content, IA and content inform design. when we design any user interface structure, we talk to the back-end people, make sure we actually can do what we think we're doing and that we're not inventing something. I mean, all the time I'm bothering a couple people going, can we do that? Is that going to put it way out of scope? And the answer is almost always, no, that's fine. We do that. It's totally routine. Developers like to tell you everything's routine, whether it is or not. but by constantly including the developer, they're not surprised by the project when it finally gets their time to put, to roll up their sleeves and work on it. They have great suggestions. And to Doug's point, everyone feels like they're part of the same team on the project. It's really, it seems like it lessens, like what tensions are there are greatly diminished when everyone feels respected and understood that way.
And I think for me, every team I had been on before I started working with HappyCog had a really broken relationship with copy, because it always came in at the very end if they thought about it at all and it didn't just come from the client. And having content be, having the content track start while IA is still going, while user research is going, and then having, for instance, design feedback on the copy while the copy is being written and real live copy going into design instead of lorem ipsum has completely changed the way that I work when I do content work. So, yeah, getting everybody involved earlier than they think they need to be, and that may not be scalable for a really big company, but right. For a small company, it works really well.
It does lead to additional iterations.
Yeah.
And it's like we are changing some IA that got approved weeks ago on a project because once we put content into the template, we found that certain things that made sense in the abstract when it was lorem ipsum, or even what that made sense when it was, for instance, copy, didn't actually make perfect sense or weren't perfectly, totally clear once we had the really specific content that was like deep in the database, right? Like deep down, what about this? Does your structure still work now? It's like, who saw the Ten Commandments and the old movie with Charlton Heston and the guy that usually played criminals and smoked cigars and was always saying like, but he comes out. Edward G. Robinson, he's like, where's your God now, Moses? it's like that guy comes out. And he's like, ah, nice structure. Try this content. So we just do, I mean, for us, we do extra rounds and don't penalize clients and tell them, we feel like this isn't perfect yet. And I think with clients, and I'm going to actually nice transition to clients, but as if planned. But with clients, if you let them, make them part of your process and let them, and don't start pulling change orders out on them every time they ask for something, and don't make it seem like a big deal to quickly change something to work better. I think it builds understanding and respect and less hostility and more willingness to pay you, which is always a big part of the job for us. Getting the money part is always nice. One thing, okay, so I want to talk a little bit about reputation management. One thing that traditional agencies do, design agencies, ad agencies, things that have been in business longer than web agencies. In order to get good clients, you do great work, win awards, and then you get clients who want that kind of work. You could have lots of debates about whether an ad agency winning awards means it actually sells products, and there's like lots of discussions that could be had, but what we're talking about right here is if someone wants a great client, they try to do amazing work. They try to validate that work by winning awards, right? And this won so many gold pencils, or this won communication arts awards. And in that way, they get clients who want that kind of work. So they won't have dictatorial clients saying, make it thinner and make this bigger and move this over here and all that stuff. Is this a viable strategy for people who create web content? Is it a viable strategy for web agencies or freelancers to go out trying to get awards? And if it is, what awards? I mean, of course, winning South by Southwest awards is very important. But aside from that, what awards could we go out and try to get that would mean anything to it? Does a Webby mean anything to a client? What do you think?
I can try this one. I don't know that a Webby does. I used to work at an agency that was really award-driven, and award season would come around, and you'd just spend like weeks and weeks preparing boards and like comping up all this crap to be sent away and pay like $50 an entry just for the sake of someone to open up your package. And it it like didn't really matter. I mean, maybe in the print world it mattered just slightly more, but it seems like to me winning web awards doesn't make that big of a difference. This type of people that I want to work with are the ones who see a site that I work on and think that it's good, or like they were able to find stuff and use it. Those are the people that I want to work with. I don't care if they want to work with me if I win some award because someone judged, you know, they like the type on the site or something like that. I just don't give a shit about that.
Anyone else? Everyone here agrees that awards are meaningless at our profession?
I would just say that I just spent last week judging the Art Directors Club Awards. I spent 4 days judging that. Next week I'm going to be judging the Communication Arts Awards. And I don't know. I mean, I respect the tradition of awards, but I don't think that they're as meaningful. But I think what they're doing is they're communicating a lack of like metrics in our profession, right? There's a lack. There's no degree in, you know, sort of like graphic design. There is a degree in graphic design. There's no certificate like we have in architecture, where someone can get certified to do certain things. So there's a sort of lacks of metrics that we're seeing, and clients need metrics in order to sort of believe and to respect. And I think that's why people sort of grasp awards, because they're the closest things we have to metrics.
I judged a magazine awards a couple months ago, and everyone agreed that these two New York Times things, remember where the plane flew into the building? Mm-hmm. The flash thing, everybody remembers that, right? It was amazing. Okay, so we kind of knew that was the most amazing stuff, but the things that won the awards weren't representative web content. Mm-hmm. I thought, wow, magazines publish content, that's what we're all about. We look for content-oriented sites for clients. That's what we specialize in. We publish a magazine. I feel like I know something about publishing web content and something about organizing it so people can find it and read it. And wouldn't it be great to find that? And here's something from the New York Times, but it was an amazing infographic. And not taking anything away from those people or their achievement. It's an amazing achievement. It's amazing visual design. But I didn't see anywhere in the magazine awards people organizing web content to be usable and easy and findable and readable, and you know, thinking of new layouts that were like easier to read or doing cool things where if it's a mobile device, it's a great layout for a mobile device, and if it's not, it's a great layout in some other. It's a great, you know, the things that people here do, like it's one layout if it's, you know, if it's 800, and if people have a wider monitor, we're going to add a column here. Things we do with CSS and stuff. I didn't see any kind of innovation like that in the magazine world that we were being asked to judge. So basically, we were judging great photo essays from Iraq that were awesome, like amazing photographers risking their lives to capture stories we need to see. But was that web design? I mean, it kind of is, but. And you're certainly not going to hire an agency based on this great photography, and you're certainly not going to say, I want that on my website. I want a great photographer to go to Iraq and get a story. It's just like, so what Jason's talking about, when people look at something and respond and go, I want that. That seems smarter than the website I have now. Do that for me. There's no metric for that, and awards aren't it. So how do we just hope that that clients that organizations are out there watching stuff and paying attention to blogs and going, wow, this person seems really talented. How does it?
Is this a me?
What do you think?
I don't know. I'd like to think that clients don't really care about awards either, but Liz is, I would say, partially right about them being sort of metrics, but I don't agree that they would be any sort of true metrics for what makes a good web design agency or good work if you know you have to pay necessarily just to be part of the competition. But how would clients find you? I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, just by doing good work, I like to think that stuff gets around and, you know, people use your websites every day and eventually they just find you, but I'm not a marketer.
Can we talk about landmark web design? There's not a slide for it, but this seems like a good place to bring it up.
To talk about
landmark web design. Because recently, who paid attention to that like 4 or 5 months ago? Okay. So remember...
for both of you.
Okay. But there's the sense, too, even among web designers, that there's something wrong with what we do. It's a little bit dull. Two columns, masthead and footer. Ho hum, yawn, yawn. Why can't I have a circle? I mean, a lot of stuff in the Flash space, design space, is driven by a desire to create new things. And is that lacking in more traditional web content development? Or
Jeffrey's baiting me because I just did a talk about this.
Yeah,
I actually think that Flash is sort of cheating in a way, because a lot of people come to design, at least approach design through like the lens of print. So, you know, what's good web design? They look at what good print design is, and then when they come to the web, they're like, oh, this doesn't look quite as good as this print design anymore. Why is that? And a lot of it actually has to do with just the general nature of the web and the nature of the medium. Things like you're really not dealing with like fixed constraints anymore, and so much of what makes good print design is based off of all these ideals and aesthetics that have been developed over the years. That are based solely on like using fixed dimensions for a piece of work, you know, rule of thirds, the golden ratio, all of this stuff, and none of that really applies in nearly the same way when it comes to the web.
Unless you use pop-up windows.
Ah, screw that. So I think that Flash is sort of cheating in that way, because you're dealing with fixed dimensions again. And when I say cheating, I mean like a lot of the stuff that we really strive for, that sort of extensibility of content and the portability of everything, and, you know, just sort of trapping it down into a Flash movie, it's kind of cheating. I don't know. It's not to say I don't respect Flash people, but...
Okay. Moving on. Okay. This is for you.
This is for me.
This is for you.
Apparently.
So, okay. So there's been a lot of hiring going on. So as we all know, and Google came for you and hired you, as Google, Apple, and other companies, Yahoo, in the last couple years, even AOL, they kind of went on hiring sprees. And they would buy, like if you had some little website that five people went to, they might buy that too, just to like throw you a bone, a sign-on bonus. But basically... what they were buying was, like they thought, was the smartest, most talented people on the web, so that they couldn't work anywhere else and would work for them. That seems like an ideal situation for there to be, if not great respect, on day one, at least a sense that you don't have to fight to do your job every day. So without putting too much spotlight on you, you got hired. Google came to you and said, you're a terrific designer. We'd like you to, what's your title?
Visual design lead.
Visual design lead. We'd like you to be our visual design lead. It's like Google is bigger than anything, and they want you to be, you, this one person, to be their visual design lead. So it seems like you should be able to just cut through the whole company with a machete and do whatever you want.
Oh, you would think, huh?
So,
it doesn't quite work that way, because to kind of shed the real light on the story, it wasn't Google coming to me, it was like, three people at Google coming to me, and three people at Google does not represent the entire company.
Okay.
So just to be fair, to set the record straight, my reputation at Google was basically only through the relationship I originally had with the Blogger guys. And that came through the redesign that we did with Adaptive Path in 2004, I think it was. So when the Google Calendar PM went looking for external design resources, the Blogger site guys said, Doug's one of the guys you should talk to if you haven't already. And I was competing with a couple of other design firms that were much larger than me. I was a single-person shop. And so basically not that many people knew my name or knew of Stop Design when I came into Google. So it was basically like I had to start all over earning that reputation again, because the, like, Wired News redesign, what? Capgemini, what? Blogger had a certain amount of credibility. But I was brought in as a contractor initially. And contractors at Google tend not to have the full cred and respect, and kind of they're almost treated sometimes as second-class citizens. And not all of them. Certainly some of them are kind of given lots of kind of cred and authority. But you're kind of kept isolated from some of the main groups sometimes. And so that was certainly the case with Calendar. The PM was kind of my go-between the engineers. And I had kind of very limited exposure to the engineers. So my ability to negotiate, to fight for certain things, was very limited, because I've kind of had this like firewall put in between me and the rest of the team. In fact, at one point, this is a very side story, but I even remember, I think a lot of you will get a kick out of this. I remember debating with the engineers. I would code up some of my little modules and prototype them, then give them to them. They'd integrate them in with their code, and then they were constantly kind of looking at my modules from my server and their modules that compiled into their code. Like, why aren't these things looking the same? And come to find out that they were using, not only were they using Quirks mode for Internet Explorer, but they were using a proprietary Firefox property to force Firefox to behave like Internet Explorer. Like, guys, come on. It was like a debate that lasted for a couple of weeks because they had to go in and rewrite a lot of their CSS and JavaScript based on that switch. But eventually that was one of the things that, at least I like to think, that I had a small hand in convincing them, like, no, it's right to go with standards mode.
Do you still feel that you have to go in and kind of fight for stuff every day?
I don't mean
in an exhaustive way, but when you present something, now have you earned the respect that you can come in and say, we're going to change to this, and they all go, like, cool.
No.
Very
few people, I think. I certainly have gained some, and I think over time, the longer that you're at Google, the more cred and respect you build up. The longer you are a Googler, and the less you are a Noogler, which is what we call new Googlers. So someone with the very senior that comes in as very Noogler will have a lot less respect than someone who has been in... You're laughing at my Noogler. Have a lot less respect than someone that's been there for 5 years but may be very junior in technical amount of experience that they've had. So it's been an uphill battle.
And who are these people doing the judging? Not to like stay on Google too long, but are you dealing with your own peers and they're deciding, or are you presenting to someone really high up and they're saying yes or no, or are you actually...
Both.
Okay, and yeah. Your peers who are at the same level as you can shoot stuff down, is what you're saying.
Since it's a very democratic process at Google, in effect, yes. Because if enough people kind of express their vocal opinion and kind of sway the rest of the group, like, no, I'm not sure if we want to, you know, do this or use this design for this product, or this feels too heavy to me, this feels too not appropriate for Google, that can sway the rest of the group as well.
Design is a democratic process?
It's a caucus, right? That's what you're saying.
Step forward and let your opinion be known.
That seems scary. Because I think design is a dictatorship.
I learned differently when I got to Google.
Yeah.
It's very much a democratic, and the entire company is very democratic. It's kind of an interesting and eye-opening company to work for because of that. Because it's so kind of, the hierarchy is very flat, and even down to the hiring process is a very flat hierarchy, and lots of people in the company have say over everyone that gets hired. It's not just the hiring manager that makes a decision and says, you're hired.
Moving on.
Killed the room. Silence.
Okay. I want to talk about content a little bit, because this is something new that we have, and Aaron will probably be answering this, but Aaron, initially... Okay, who's had the experience of... Which freelancers have had the experience of writing the copy for the client just to put something in there, and then it went live?
Okay. Oh, no.
Okay, and who's... And, like, even ridiculous stuff, yeah. And okay. And waiting for the content and it never being ready, who's had that experience? Okay. And so this sets up a very antagonistic dynamic between, you know, the in-house content people and the in-house design team, or the client and the designer. Because at this point, the designer wants to finish the job and get paid and is being held up because the client hasn't supplied the copy. And the copy is just this junk that everyone's waiting for instead of something meaningful that's the most meaningful thing on the website that the users are coming to find, and the thing that's driving the whole user experience. So in the last couple of years, we've noticed a shift where there's a little bit more respect for the content process. And do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I think a lot of our clients have by now experienced what it's like to get held up for 3 months or 6 months or a year because the content wasn't there. Or experience things like the accidental lorem ipsum went live, and so on. And so I think that a lot of the reason that clients are coming to us looking for content strategy, for editorial help, is because they've seen it explode in their faces before. Which is great, because then they come to us and they're all soft and ready to be molded. But it doesn't mean we're not still selling content at every step. From the proposal all the way through, every content document we do is still, it's still a sales document in some ways. We're still going over, you know, why this stuff matters, because even if the client contact gets it, that doesn't mean that the person who eventually flips the switch or who replaces them in 6 months gets it. So even our style guides that we do for editorial style have all of the whys, why this is important, why you should care. And, you know, just as we try to get content involved in the design process and vice versa, we try to get the content ideas across to the people on the client team who aren't in charge of content. Although that's fairly rare that we have someone on the client team who's just in charge of content. But it's all the way through. It's still trying to tie it in. Also, something we've been doing, I think, more in the last couple of years since we saw clients start to be a little more content savvy was at the beginning of every document, and I think this is true actually for information architecture too and some to some degree design, so you know, this is what we've done so far. You'll see these same principles, user-centered design. You saw this in information architecture. Now you're going to see it in content. You'll see it again later in design. It's all tied together. You can't take this stuff apart. If you're going to have a website, it's going to have all these components and they relate in these ways. And that seems to help. People conceive of all of these parts as a whole. And if you have a client who called us because they read your book about web standards, then we may need to sell them more on design, and we may need to sell them more on content. And so integrating it all, taking the whole process to them as a whole and re-emphasizing that over and over seems to have helped. They may get sick of it.
You're talking too about the sort of the Alzheimer's method. When what we do,
I wasn't going to call it that.
Yeah, I feel my mom died from it, so I feel free to use that term. And like, it's when I was talking to my mom, I'd remind her what we talked about before, and just keep going through it and being very patient. And we do this with our clients, and we do this in our documents. So when we sit down at the meeting, we say, "Here's where we were. Here's why we." What you asked for, and as Aaron just said, here are the principles on which, you know, it's user-centered, this is what your users told us, this is what the research showed. We say that every time, and it seems like, wow, you're talking down to your client, but we're not. The client may have just left a meeting where they found out that the wheat they were counting on for their bread, that the wheat crop died, and they can't raise the price of the bread, but they're going to have to spend more for the wheat. Or they just left a meeting where, that's a kind of a crazy one, but they just left a meeting where they find out that they got to lay off five people, or they left a meeting where they've been discussing business problems. So the web stuff isn't top of mind for them. It's not that they don't care. It's that it's not the most important thing to them on the day that they just found out they didn't get the promotion, or they have to give their office to a junior person, or they lost the key to the executive bathroom, or whatever it is. And so you sit down with them and remind them what it is you're dealing with and what stage you're in. And the documents do the same thing. And yeah, all our IA documents now start pretty pretty general and mm-hmm. talking about principles and what we hope to achieve. And another analogy that you've used, Aaron, is the sort of the GIF analogy.
Oh yeah, I've been showing content strategy to our clients in terms of you know, here's a really pixelated JPEG from a long time ago, and here's the JPEG resolving, and here's the beautiful palm tree, and it's crisp. And our content process is the same way. We're going to start really abstract, and that shows up in our other phases as well. But I wanted to mention that. You know, some of our clients, all of our clients, most of our clients, know their own businesses really well. And there's a really wide variation in their levels of sophistication about our industry, which is fine. I mean, that's why they hire us. Sometimes we have clients, we have one right now, who is really sophisticated about the web and can ask really hard questions. And we haven't had to do the kind of selling that is, you know, this is a wireframe and this is why it's important. This is navigation. And that's fine when you have to do that, but even when you don't, it doesn't mean you can relax. It just means you can go deeper. So content with clients who are really content savvy just means we can take that opportunity to do more interesting content stuff and get into things that are beyond the style guide. If they have a staff of editors, then great, we don't need to talk about M dashes. You know, we can go ahead and talk about long-term editorial strategy, and I'm sure that holds true for the other disciplines as well.
And you don't write all the copy for the website.
Usually,
that's not what it's about.
No, because, I mean, in most cases, the client needs to at least start that process or have a writer in-house or a writer they hire to work alongside them. It's very difficult as an agency to write it all from outside. Sometimes I am that writer, and I'll step in and work with them for 3 months, but we do have to start the content process on our end, or we'll never see it.
But it's more like imposing a voice or a style, because they may have 7 different people creating content, and it reads like it. And so there's this filter that's basically saying, okay, for this website to be cool and feel like one mind, feel like a real entity, feel like your corporate presence or your friendly, warm environment or whatever it is that we're trying to create in the design and the architecture, well, then follow these rules and use this person, and these kinds of jokes are okay but not this kind, or it's okay to be funny here but not there. I mean, we really do make these little spectrums, almost behavioral spectrums, so that they can sort of throw their problems at it later, and it's almost like a grid where they can go, okay, that's where we have to be serious because that's where we're talking about the health stuff. So right. So the puns probably don't go there.
No puns on the heart attack page, yeah,
right.
Exactly. And they mostly know, I think, intuitively what they should sound like. That's actually sort of the easy thing. It's just getting that out of their heads and onto the website so that you don't have things really inappropriately showing up.
Well, sometimes clients have a marketing background, which is awesome. Any marketers in the house? Okay, marketing's awesome. But sometimes they fall in love with their own writing ability, and you'll get a site that reads a little too marketing and not enough web. Right, so it's got like one catchy phrase after another, and it's almost like some salesman barging in a door, you know, with like slick phrases and opening boxes and stuff. And it's just like, so we just like sort of not dumb it down, but like normalize it a little bit, make it more like people talk.
A conversation, right.
IA, hello. So who works in IA, or has IA is a big part of your process in what you do? Who just like designs stuff randomly and doesn't really think about users? Okay, honesty is good. It's the first step toward healing. Okay. Just
riff on it.
Yeah, just. I mean, isn't there a kind of a built-in respect factor with IA because it's so much about talking to the client and really getting to know them and.
Well, you know, I think clients are really interested in IA, but to be honest, I'm not sure that most of them understand exactly what it means until it starts happening. You know, our IA process involves 2 steps, user research and the structural design. And so the user research comes way up front, and we always do stakeholder interviews. And so stakeholder interviews, because they happen within the first couple of weeks when we engage with a client, are my opportunity and the information architects on the project opportunity to sit with the clients one by one, many, many interviews behind like closed doors. And those sessions become very much like therapy sessions. There's this moment that I know that a client starts to trust us or respect us when the client will be talking and suddenly he or she will get up and like go close the door. And everything after that point, it's like this tipping point in our relationship with the client, where everything after that point is like, I know coming, you know, from a really good place, and everything's going to sort of be okay with this client. But it's that closing the door moment is really important. And I think at that point, they're really open to understanding what the IA process is all about, and they know that they're involved with the process. And that involvement, back to some of the points we were making earlier, is really key to helping them understand that they're a big part of the process. We're not just sort of going off and creating crazy deliverables without them.
You could do that in-house, too.
Absolutely.
This doesn't have to be an agency client perspective, and it doesn't even have to be an IA perspective.
No.
If all of us would go into the room and talk to the other people we're working with about their problems, what they're trying to achieve, mm-hmm. and get them on board and have that... what you just beautifully said, the sort of like close the door moment where that's when they're going to let their hair down and tell you the truth, it would be a lot easier. There'd be less combat later, I would think. Yep. Because, I mean, that's how it works in the agency business, because they go, oh, yeah, I trust these people. We had that conversation. They know about. They know my secret.
Mm-hmm. And I think in-house it becomes, I wouldn't say more important at all, but in-house one of the problems that I've had in the past is getting invited to the meetings.
Yes.
Right, because the process, and it's different at a place like Google, I would imagine, but with medium-sized companies, small companies, the process is often not as well-defined. So stuff can get built, and you don't have to go through traditional research, IA, you know, design kind of process. And so if you gain their trust like that, if you have a close the door moment with them, they will most likely invite you to the next meeting because they know that you've like created this like understanding with them that they find valuable.
What I've always said about that too, although it kind of sucks because it's not fun, but it's just be willing to do extra work because that makes a big difference. Like I worked in a place where even though I was the creative director, they really saw me as someone designing interfaces, and they would have meetings with clients and not invite me. They would make huge decisions about projects and not invite me. And I kept saying, you know, and so what I started doing is coming to work earlier and staying later and doing all my work so that there really wasn't a reason. I'd say, hey, are you going to meet with the client today? I'd talk to the project manager and say, what's on so-and-so's agenda today? Which is a perfectly legitimate question to ask. What's on Gary's agenda today? And say, oh, they're meeting with the library group. Oh, okay. And then say, hey, I'd like to be involved in that meeting in the library group. And they'd say, but you have all this other work to do. And I go, get it. Can I come with you? And or I'll do it tonight, or I'll do it on Saturday. It sucks because you shouldn't have to do that. But most places, in-house or agency, don't build in, let's put a lot of room for all our people to feel like they're part of the process and give us their creative ideas. Most places really do want you just in there coloring pixels or in there writing CSS or whatever it is that you do. They sort of see you as this little part of the machine. And I think it's really important to break out of that trap. Mm-hmm. And that does mean working extra hours, at least for a while. Mm-hmm. A reputation for design can sometimes seems like it should be a good thing in terms of getting good design clients. So, Jason, as a representative designer where you work, have you found that having a reputation keeps clients from asking you to Frankenstein stuff together and listen to you when you make recommendations? And
I'd like to think it does, but oftentimes, I mean, you never really get out of the Frankensteining thing, and I think as you develop more of a reputation and maybe your clients respect you more, it sort of divides them sometimes. If you present them with three designs, they might be so petrified to offend you that they don't want to combine anything from any of the three designs, which can be fantastic. But then on the flip side of that, they might respect you enough that they figure, you know, these three designs are like a tapas menu, and I can just select whatever I want and just throw everything together. You'll figure it out. You're good. But I think the most important thing is just sort of setting an expectation from the moment that you walk in the door, from that very first meeting, you know, setting yourself up as the sort of, I guess, the expert on design. You know, you wear your creative director costume, and you walk the walk, and you talk the talk. And part of that is sort of just gently nudging them, letting them know that you know what you're talking about with design, and you're sort of holding the keys. If they want to know if they can do something, it kind of has to almost be approved by you, whether they know that consciously or not. They want to sort of interact with you to figure out how to best approach that design problem.
Would you say it's fair? I think design is more personal than anything else in this process, even in the words. It's that somehow they'll let people create structures and navigation labels, and they may not entirely buy a navigation label, but they'll sort of go, well, I guess that makes sense, and once you're actually creating the visual aspect of who they are, that becomes very personal. That's like a photograph or something, and then they become much more picky. No matter how good a reputation you have, it seems like it's easier to sell all the other steps. All the other steps help you get to the point where they trust you and are willing to buy design, but man, with design, there's just so much ego at stake for them, and so much like, you know, I don't feel brown. That's nice, but it's brown, and I think I'm more tangerine. I mean, there's lots of stuff that's totally emotional that you have to respond to in a respectful way, and yet find a way to turn aside, whether through research or... And because you can't say, where did you go to art school?
Yeah.
You could say it. It's fun for a second.
It doesn't get you anywhere.
It's not going to get you anywhere.
It's very much a, you know, make lemonade kind of situation. I don't know. It doesn't ever get easier, too.
You try to get people thinking strategically, too.
I do. One of the things that I really try to do when involved in like a presentation for something, I try to really get the clients to focus on problems rather than solutions for things. Because if you present them with, you know, three designs, you're basically giving them three different collections of solutions to a bunch of different problems. So if they like parts of one, they'll be like, oh, well, this works well in this design, and I like most of this design. What if we just solve that problem that you have with this other piece from this thing here? But if you try to get them to think more about problems rather than solving, you know, whatever they come up with the pieces that are in front of them, it seems to work out a little bit better, because they're starting to think more about how something is functioning and how it's working and what's succeeding and what's not, rather than redesigning it right there on the fly.
We also we might present work with no name attached. You know, it'll just be A, B, and C. But after they've looked at it for a little while, we can tell them what problem we were solving. So A is more an e-commerce site, and B is more a repository of knowledge. Okay, so if you're a publisher, maybe you're a publisher who's got millions of titles, so I feel like I'm in a library. That's the feeling we're going for with B. And with A, you really want to sell some books, so let's sell some books. Okay, and so then it makes it less about, I want to take this nav bar and stick it over here, and I like this color scheme, but with these columns. Because what you're presenting, although they still have every right to do that, they can still keep trying to do that, but what you're trying to get them to think about is, this says you're selling, this says this about you, this says that about you. When we worked on AIGA, there was like three different stories that could be told. One was, AIGA, are you good enough? Probably not. You know? Right? And another one was, AIGA, it's kind of like Martha Stewart, it's fun. And so there were two different designs that, it sounds ridiculous, but it
was. He did these voices during the presentation, too.
Yeah, the voices really help, and the puppets, I think, are. But things that hadn't been resolved in all the user research and in all the discussions, right? We had a lot of discussions. Who are you really? Here's what some of you users say, you're aloof and they can't connect with you, so you might want to address that problem. Others say you're letting the riffraff in, so you might want to, you know, and those things are contradictory, and they couldn't decide. So it's finally like, well, here's two layouts. And then if your heart goes that way, then that's really the answer. It's almost like design is a way to answer the question that you couldn't answer when you were being rational, when you were using words to talk about it, whether you were aloof or friendly. No one wants, because it's like that South Park episode where they got the racist flag, and they're asking the man on the street what he thinks, and he keeps going, well, it is racist, but it is history. Remember this episode of South Park? Okay. And it's kind of like that. You ask them what they want, and they say, well, we want to be aloof, but we want to be friendly. But if you show them two designs, they'll actually make a decision. So that, I think, helps. Awards we've talked about. And metrics we started to talk about. Is there any benefit, Liz, do you think, in okay, take a company like Adaptive Path, this brilliant company, and they're constantly putting out white papers where they explain in general kind of what they think about user experience and very specific ideas they have about it, and it seems to bring in the business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Adaptive Path, as an example, very early on started giving stuff away.
Right.
And by stuff, I mean white papers. And other things that they would attach to those white papers. And I think, like, to Jason's point earlier, people respect things that they can understand. And Adaptive Path, by giving this stuff away, and other companies that produce white papers and seminars and so on, give people a vocabulary and a set of, you know, just, like, stuff to sort of, like, hold on to and hold up. And
Jared Spool, Jacob Nielsen.
Yeah, so many examples out there. Jared's conference and Jared Spool's conference takes the conference material and podcasts it and does webinars and all kinds of stuff that you can interact with online. And all of that is really useful for people because we don't have this like standard set of metrics that we can point to. So I would, I'm a big believer in giving stuff away when you can, to a point.
And when you give that away and explain how stuff works, does it then make the in-house people smarter or the client smarter? Who's had a good experience by bringing in a consultant or by showing your boss a white paper and it's made them agree with you? Who's done the thing where they're not listening to you, so you find some expert who says the same thing you do? Okay, I'm seeing some hands. Okay. I remember talking to a guy a long time ago. He was a president of a company, a web company. And I said, you can read Jacob Nielsen's stuff free on his website, or you can pay $30 and buy his book. Why would you pay $25,000 to have him come talk to you for an hour when he's going to say the same stuff? And this guy said, I'd do that in a heartbeat. And I said, why would you do that? And he said, if that's going to get my board of directors to listen to the point that I've been trying to make for 3 months, it's worth the $25,000. So the answer is hire Jacob Nielsen. Respect. Okay. Do we have time a little bit to talk about the press and how to... are we late? Are we over?
I think we're on it.
We're on it?
It's not the actual time.
Is this 6 o'clock?
Yeah.
Golly, I missed the whole... well, thank you.